From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's a part of KCRW's Independent Producer Project, a laboratory for independent radio producers, writers, and performers. We're beginning the third year of this program, highlighting and creating unforgettable radio stories. If you're new to the program, you can find all the old shows at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. Don't forget to like the show on Facebook when you're there. And follow us on Twitter, too, at Unfictional. But today, on the program, another episode created for Unfictional by legendary radio storyteller Joe Frank. He was a fixture here at KCRW between 1986 and 2002, producing several dark, absurd, often hilarious series of programs that blurred the line between autobiography and radio fiction. He's won a lot of awards, including a Peabody and a Lifetime Award from the Third Coast International Audio Festival. He's written books and plays and television programs. And by the way, there's an archive of Joe's work at his website, joefrank.com. You can listen to all his past material there if you've never heard it before or you'd like to hear it again. But a few months back, Joe Frank started writing and assembling new stories for this program. And today, it's the third one we've aired on Unfictional on KCRW.com. This is called Old Man by Joe Frank.
About a year ago, I met a woman on Facebook. It began innocently, funny comments on each other's threads, then inboxing, during which she told me she was married, with two children, had once wanted to be a classical pianist, but now gave lessons, and that her husband had not made love to her for so long that she couldn't remember how it felt. Neither of us knew what the other looked like. My profile picture had been taken when I was 53. Hers was of a woman walking through a lush countryside. The picture was somewhat out of focus. We began talking on the phone. At first, we flirted. Then we got a little naughty. It was like mutually assured seduction. And eventually, we started to have phone sex, during which I showed remarkable sexual stamina. I could last for 4 or 5 hours as I drove her to heights of ecstasy. After about a year, we began talking, very gingerly and cautiously, about actually meeting. At first, we cracked jokes about it. We spoke about how it would probably kill the relationship and had some engrossing conversations about the nature of fantasy and romance. What would it be like if we met? We had no idea. But how much longer could we go on like this? Forever? At some point, we'd have to resolve the mystery. So we arranged to meet at Starbucks for coffee. As I approached up the block, I could see her through the window. She looked similar to her Facebook profile picture. She was wearing jeans, hiking boots, a bush jacket, and a turtleneck sweater. She appeared down to earth and radiated ruddy good looks. And I imagined sitting in her van with her black lab leaning out the rear window as we drove out to the country for an afternoon of hiking, or spelunking, or rappelling, or depending. At the same time, through the same window, she could see me approaching with my cane, taking small, mindful steps, and leaning forward because of my bent spine. I could immediately see that she wasn't exactly pleased with me. I wasn't her type. We engaged in a short, strained conversation. It was over. I knew I'd aimed too high. In the future, I'd have to be realistic. Woman, early 70s, with rare blood disease that causes the walls of her cells to dissolve and her organs to disorganize, so that occasionally she bleeds through the pores of her skin or cries drops of blood. Seeks man with wonderful sense of humor and positive outlook on life. Woman, 80, former fashion model, now reduced to moving slowly and painfully with limited range of motion, holding walker for balance. Husband made fortune designing line of hot sauces you could apply directly to your genitals. Died when carried away by band of feral monkeys. Smokers need not apply. Actually, anyone can apply. I've had no response to this ad for 2 years now. A week ago, I went to a dinner party. A lot of banter, laughter, repartee, everything moving too fast for me. I'd think of something to say, but by the time I'd formulated it, the conversation had moved on to another subject. I was barely able to keep up, turning my head one way and then another, like watching a tennis match. Not long ago, I'd been in the middle of these lively conversations, firing off jokes and riposts. Now, I hardly said anything. At one point, I looked at my watch to see how old I was and wondered if I was losing my mind. I was afraid to eat because my hands trembled and it would be too humiliating to spill my soup or drop food off my fork onto the tablecloth. So I barely ate anything at all. At the end of the meal, when I got up from the table, I lost my balance and saved myself from falling by grasping the credenza. Later, we sat in the living room drinking coffee and eating pastries. I was having a conversation with a documentary filmmaker when a piece of cake and whipped cream fell off my fork and landed on my wristwatch. She didn't seem to notice and continued talking as I wiped off my watch with a napkin. I asked her, "Why did you ignore the fact that I just dropped food on my watch? Were you trying to avoid embarrassing me?" She said she hadn't noticed. I told her she was lying. She got up and walked off. I moved over to the couch. I lay back, staring up at the ceiling. I was thirsty and decided to risk lifting a glass of wine. But as I brought it to my mouth, my hand shook so violently that the wine spilled on my shirt. When I reached for a napkin to wipe it off, I slid off the sofa and landed on the floor. People rushed over to me. "Are you all right?" "Of course I am. I'm just doing an impression of Dick Van Dyke, but I doubt you remember him." People open doors for me, reach out to help me, gesture for me to get off elevators before they do. Yesterday, a woman encouraged her 5-year-old daughter to open a door for me. The little girl was proud of her achievement, and I smiled through gritted teeth. Little bitch. I was on the way to my anger management class when a speeding Carrera, weaving from lane to lane, cut me off. I had to jam on the brakes to avoid an accident while a sports car accelerated and disappeared in a cluster of other vehicles. I was furious. Then, up ahead, the light changed and I found myself pulling up next to the Carrera. There were 4 college-aged kids sitting inside. And I turned to the driver and said, "What the hell are you doing? You're driving like a maniac. You could kill somebody." And he said, "Advice from an old man." This cracked everyone up in his car. And I completely lost it. In a rage, I screamed at him. I'm going to find out where you live, and I'm going to come over one night and cut you open with a razor blade, reach into your body and take out your gallbladder and smear it all over your face. Then I'm going to pull out your liver and your heart and feed them to my dog, Ollie, and cut off two of your fingers and stick them in your ears and gouge out your eyes and squash them under my shoes and set you on fire. The driver said, "Wow." And when the light changed, he took off with such speed that my car seemed to be moving backwards. It's a beautiful fall afternoon. The sun is low, shining through the trees, highlighting the red and gold of the foliage. I look at the vine-covered walls of the library and the Greek columns of the science building. I watch students, in twos and threes, walking along carrying their knapsacks and school bags, some talking earnestly, others laughing. A girl on a bicycle rides by. Two boys are throwing a football back and forth on the quad. And there's a small group listening to a young man playing a guitar. I watch the rapt expressions on the faces of the students. Among them, a tall, slender co-ed, so beautiful that she takes my breath away. But she looks right through me. As an older man, I know I don't exist any longer as attractive or desirable. And I remember the time when I was a young man and had many affairs with students as beautiful as she. The sky begins to cloud over. It starts to rain. Rather than run indoors, the students begin to dance. I walk through the downpour and into the tool shed where the gardeners keep their lawnmowers and rakes and hoes and shovels. When I hear the rain stop and the chapel bell ring, I walk back out onto the quad. The air is turned cold. There's a chill wind. The quad is deserted. I'm the only one there, except for a student dressed as a clown. And I imagine walking over to him, tearing off his bushy red wig, pulling off his bulbous nose, and pushing him into the duck pond. It's odd. You don't experience your own death. The last thing you experience is the last moment of your life. When you die, you have no idea that you just died. If you suddenly die at home, your friends and relatives grieve and cry and embrace. It's very emotional. It's a tragedy. You're gone. But at the same time, you're not completely gone, because your body is still lying on the floor of your apartment. It's as if you've gone off on a trip from which you'll never return and left an unseemly mess behind. And that mess is you. In my opinion, it would make more sense and be much easier on everyone if you just flashed from existence. So there you are, on the floor, lying dead with your eyes open. And why you don't close your eyes is a mystery to me. It would be so much easier on the rest of us, because now someone will have to reach over and draw your eyelids down so that you appear to be sleeping. That person is not going to be me. Now I know I'm being morbid. I probably should be talking about something uplifting, like maybe a maternity ward with fresh little babies lying in rows, just entering the hardships, challenges, and abominations of life. Now, some people say that I'm too negative and cynical. "Why do you have to be such a downer?" one friend said, and began mocking me by singing, "I'm happy when I'm sad. I'm always feeling bad." But I don't care, because I have other things to think about. For example, I can't imagine how morticians do it. It seems like the worst job in the world, and I wonder how their profession affects them psychologically. How does it shape their worldview? Are they atheists, or do they believe in God? And what do they do for fun? Do they play golf on the weekends? Do they go sailing? Do they have backyard barbecues with all their mortician friends? And what's a mortician like in bed? While you're making love to a mortician, you'd probably smell the faint odor of formaldehyde. And if you didn't smell it, you'd think you were smelling it. Maybe I'll live on a beach in Rio. I'll sit in the shade of an awning, extending from the back of my truck, and just kick back and relax. Later, at dusk, I'll take my surfboard and swim out beyond the breakers. I'll wait for the right moment, climb on, and go slashing ahead of a huge, curling wave. Then, in the evenings, I'll play guitar and percussion in a hot samba band. Except that it's too late. Often, in the middle of a sentence, I'll trail off and won't remember what I was talking about. I'll have reached the predicate and lost the subject, which will become misted and too distant from the completion of the thought to provide a counterbalance, and so tip over the edge of awareness and tumble away into whatever. While my young friends have unlocked the mysteries of the internet and speak in a cyber language I can't understand, I take naps in the afternoon and hobble from room to room, frantically looking for my glasses. People die mowing lawns, chopping wood, shoveling snow. They die on park benches, in movie theaters, waiting online in supermarkets. They die planning their weddings at cemeteries, fall forward into a grave, and have dirt thrown on them. People die running naked through the angry streets. And why are the streets angry? Because no one cares about them. They're neglected. People die driving in snowstorms, lose their way, run out of gas, and freeze to death in their cars while making love. People die placing cell phone calls from construction sites, inadvertently blowing up caches of dynamite and being buried under tons of debris. Some people die doing push-ups in their shorts. Others die in museums looking at abstract impressionists. Miles Davis died playing Kind of Blue. The tune was immediately renamed Kind of Dead. People die slowly, wasting away in hospices. Some of them outlive family members who come to visit, and even outlive their nurses and doctors and the woman who comes in and mops the floor. Sometimes we speak of people flirting with death, people who climb mountains, drive too fast, take too many drugs. And sometimes we speak of courting death. Having x-rays is like ordering dinner. I'll have a bone scan and an MRI, please. This is often followed by anesthesia, where you are rendered unconscious, and then a very intimate and invasive event takes place, where one or two organs are fondled and taken out. And then, as your illness gets worse, you enter the final death throes, similar to the ecstasy associated with sexual activity, where you sweat, say foolish things, jerk spasmodically, and thrash around. And then, finally, there's a tremendous release of tension, and the body goes limp. There was a time when I danced on a street corner, dressed as a chicken. My job was to draw attention to a furniture store down the block. One evening, when my shift was over, still wearing my chicken outfit, I walked into a bar across the street. I ordered a Bombay martini, straight up, olives on the side. A prostitute sat down next to me. She was young, willowy, had a faraway look in her eyes. Her name was Meredith. We talked about our careers, the importance of networking, setting goals, focus. Then I excused myself, walked into the men's room, entered a stall, and sat down on the toilet, and had a bowel movement that broke in two, and half of it was still hanging out of me, so I had to wipe myself 50 times, repeatedly checking to see if there was more left on the toilet paper. And written on the wall were the words, "Know that someone is suffering anonymously and unknown, and that by the time you read this, I'll be dead." Years ago, I felt so lonely that I got involved with an oak tree behind my house. I'd put my arms around it for comfort. I considered it my best friend. After all, who knew the inner lives of trees? Maybe they had thoughts and feelings unavailable to us. Maybe they spoke in a language humans couldn't hear. And maybe my friend took solace in my hugs as much as I did in giving them. And so, during the summer, I'd sit in the shade under the protective arms of my beloved tree. The skies were blue, the air heavy with the perfumes of late summer, insects humming, birds singing, a gentle breeze brushing against my skin. I'd have a wicker basket lying open beside me, with a bottle of wine, a wheel of cheese, a loaf of crusty peasant bread, an apple, and a slender volume of poems. And lifting my guitar, I'd sing a few songs while gazing off at the distant peaks of snow-capped mountains. And then I'd give my tree another hug. My friends at the leisure club were shocked and dismayed. "What are you doing?" they said. "Are you out of your mind? Do you really think it's possible to have a meaningful relationship with a tree? We understand you're lonely. A lot of us are. But we don't get involved with large plants. We don't hug bark and kiss leaves. You've got to pull yourself together and stop this nonsense. And look, if you need to hug someone, why not choose a real person?" And then one of them told me about taxi dancing. I'd never heard of it before. He explained that it took place in a large hall where men paid to dance with girls in their early to mid-20s. So one night, my friend took me with him. I saw couples holding each other, hardly moving to the music. I watched and then asked a girl to dance. She rested her head on my shoulder and we held each other and I felt comforted. We didn't speak because I didn't want to ruin the purity of the moment. And as I danced with her, I wondered if the tree outside my house was grieving because it somehow could see us. That night, when I came home, I gave it a big hug and then returned to the club every night for weeks, dancing with the same nameless girl, never speaking a word, until one day she stopped showing up. By that time, my tree was involved with an investment banker who lived across the street. I'd watched them together, my heart breaking. When you hug people goodbye after a social event, perhaps a dinner party or a gallery opening, there is always that moment when they squeeze you more forcefully than before, a polite way of letting you know they are about to withdraw. Usually, the one who disengages first is the one who cares less. When this used to happen to me, I felt rejected and humiliated. I'd come home with a lonely, sick feeling. And that's why, in order to assume the power position and gain the psychological advantage, I now hug people very briefly, perhaps 1 or 2 seconds, before freeing myself. Sometimes, if I detect any resistance, I'll push the person away. In one instance, I caused a woman to fall backwards over a chair, injuring her back, which led to her hospitalization. But I had no choice. It was a matter of self-preservation.
Unfictional on KCRW.com. You've been listening to Old Man, written and narrated by Joe Frank. Music by Joe Frank and David Rolicky. Featuring David Rolicky on saxophone and flute, mixed by Ray Guarna. Special thanks to Michael Story.
I'm a 70-year-old nigga. I never pull a trigger. But I will. I don't want to hurt nobody, but I'm tired. Everybody f***ing over me. I'm a 70-year-old nigga.
I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Jacob Conrad. The music supervisor is Dan Wilcox. Production assistance from Monica Scott. Thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support of the Independent Producer Project. You can find past episodes at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. You can like the show on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Unfictional. You can podcast the show or listen on demand with the KCRW mobile app. And if you do like the program, please tell your friends about it. I'm Bob Carlson, and however you choose to listen, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW and KCRW.com.